The Theosophical Society presents Felix Leighton in a talk entitled Light on the Path.
We live today in a world of massive reading. You know, in every profession, business, engineering, medical profession, teaching, even students in universities and schools, more and more they have to read more and more, get more and more facts in order to keep up. And through this process of reading, a flood of facts are poured into their mind. This is so much the case that we find courses being given to enable people to speed up their reading, and advice being given as to how you can skim through things and thereby read a vast amount of material in a short time. This is a typical product of our age, but it's a beautiful contrast, I think of one old, archaic book well known to many members of the Theosophical Society, which contains two chapters, each chapter of which contains only 5 pages, each page of which has on it only 3 sentences, and some of them not more than 4 words each sentence. And yet this book was produced and given to serious thinkers as something to read and to study for a whole lifetime. As I say, it's a welcome and delightful contrast to this rush of massive reading of our present day, and requires a completely a different approach towards life in order to appreciate it. This book, as I said, was written and given as a guide for life as a whole, for the whole lifetime of the pupil who was reading it. And it was said that the amount of information and instruction contained in this book was sufficient that if the pupil would understand it, follow it, and live in his life everything that he learned, he would then have unfolded all his spiritual capacities. He would, as it were, be one of the flowers on the trees of Earth's humanity. I know 2 other such books which are equally small, or almost so. One is The Voice of the Silence, which I always think of as the book for the individual who seeks to approach perfection, to unfold his own divinity, especially through the power of his will, a book perhaps specially suited for the first ray or the seventh ray type of individuals. Another one, that wonderful little book, At the Feet of the Master. Again, a book which contains in it, if you will study it and live it, enough to enable you to reach perfection. A book perhaps particularly suitable to the individual who treads the path of the heart, particularly the second ray and the sixth ray individuals. And this book that I am referring to first, because of all its references to nature, Light on the Path, being particularly the book of the individuals who approach through this hunger or this search for truth through the path of the mind. And just to give you an idea, in case there are any of you here who are not familiar with it, here is 1 page from the original book. It would be 1/10 of the original book, something for you to brood over and seek to understand. Listen to the song of life. Store in your memory the melody you hear. Learn from it the lesson of harmony. And that is one page, such a wonderful contrast to the way we have to read and study in these days. And in order to understand it, of course, you have to meditate on it and try to understand what is this song of life to which you are to listen. Now, this book, so far as I have gone with it, is a very old book. And it has been undoubtedly used by many individuals who, with its help, have unfolded their spiritual powers. But there was one in particular who used it, who studied with it, and was helped by it to attain perfection. And before he quite reached that stage, he had a disciple or a pupil who was seeking to learn from him in Alexandria, and he gave to that pupil this book, giving it in the groups of three rules or sentences, but in each case adding after those three a fourth rule or expansion of the idea, something which he had discovered as the result of meditation on those things for a very long period of time. So that the book thus was added to from its original 30 sentences by these 10 or 11 more. Then that was done perhaps in the 3rd century AD or somewhere around then. The young man to whom it was given, or the pupil, Iamblichus, later on, after seeking to follow that great teacher, who became the Chohan, or the Lord whom we refer to as the Venetian Chohan, the great teacher of the third ray, the teacher who approached particularly through this aspect of the third ray and who represents all the best in that particular approach. The teacher with whom the color green, for instance, is always associated. And all those particular attributes which come from developing the power of the higher mind. And the disciple to whom he gave it, Iamblichus, following in the footsteps of this teacher, also was able to fully unfold these latent powers within himself, so that he also attained perfection as far as humanity is concerned, and he also chose then to stay as one of those great Chohans who remain to watch and to guide evolving humanity and to give whatever help they can and are permitted to those of us who seek to follow in their footsteps. And he became the great Chohan, the Master Hilarion, of the fifth ray. The ray particularly dealing with the development of the power of the lower mind, the great scientist. And very early in the history of the Theosophical Society, he decided that it would be a good thing for the world and for the members of the Theosophical Society if once again this extraordinary archaic book was given to seeking man to be there and to be of help to those who wished to tread that path which he and his teacher had trodden. And so, once again, it was given to the world by him through Mabel Collins as light on the path, with now a third comment or set of notes added added here and there wherever he thought it was necessary, representing those thoughts and ideas which had come to this mighty individual as he had unfolded his divine powers in trying to understand and live in accordance with the rules of this book. And so we have the book given in a form which is really an extraordinarily interesting one, one which fits in so well with groups, with people who attempt to work, for instance, by the group method, because you find in every one of the original pages, you find, first of all, the three rules from the archaic book. Then you have the comments of the great Lord of the Third Ray, who had followed it in the past and who adds his comments. And then you find, in addition, the comments of another who used this book and who followed it and who developed his powers along the line of the Fifth Ray. So that it stands there with one idea, then that idea looked at from one point of view, and then looked at from another point of view, which is an extremely valuable way to enable us to find for ourselves what the meaning of this book is. I wanted to talk about this book because of its direct connection with nature in so many ways. But I want to talk about it in this way in introducing the subject. First, because I think then you will be able to appreciate more, perhaps, the significance of it. A question which one might very easily ask then would be, how should one read this book? The technique of reading, as taught in modern universities, shall we say, where they try to get you to be able to read 1,000 words a minute, and the technique of reading a book like this are obviously completely different. Perhaps one might say the exact opposite of one another. But if I was asked, how should one read Light on the Path if you had never read it before, I would say perhaps approach it with successive views, like somebody approaching the earth on a rocket from some great distance might. First of all, he would see the whole world. And first of all, looking at this book, I would say, and it is, after all, only 25 pages with the original rules and the commentaries of both of these great ones. First of all, read the whole thing right through from beginning to end. And that would represent the overview, and perhaps do that two or three times at intervals of two or three days. And gradually, you will find that something of the inspiration and the magnetism of this book will, so to speak, begin to surround you, or you will be able to enter into it. Then you will find that you will want, after having done this, to read it more slowly and more closely, perhaps taking one page, that is, one set of those three rules. The fourth rule being the commentary of the Master the Venetian and any notes that there may be in those four rules. And you will find then that you will want to take those and brood on those and try to understand them, perhaps trying to merge yourself in some way with the magnetism of those great beings who in the past were enabled to tread the path by following those three rules, by the magnetism of the Master the Venetian himself, who gave this as the essence of his understanding of it to his pupil, and by the comments or the notes of the Master Hilarion also. It's an extraordinary privilege to us, really, that such a book is available in the world. Some special points, perhaps, with regard to it are that it uses over and over again the method of the paradox. That is, two statements are made, which you feel are true, and yet which are apparently contradictory. And it is, I think, a quality of this book, which is especially, I think, one for the mind, that you there have these apparently contradictory statements. And the mind has to think about it and ponder about these things which appear to contradict one another until it can reach a level higher than that at which it can see that both of these things, which apparently are contradictions, are in reality different aspects of the same truth. Some of the contrasts with the paradoxes or apparent conflicts: though thou fightest, be not thou the warrior. Kill out all sense of separateness, yet stand alone and isolated. And if you read the book through, you will find dozens of such paradoxes. And if you ponder over them, you will find that behind them there are wonderful truths which embrace these apparent contradictions. It's been said that chapter one, or the first half of the book, is intended for aspirants towards discipleship, people who are, so to speak, approaching the path, and that the second half represents the teachings for those who are already disciples and who are treading the final stages of the path. And so one might think, well, if I'm not a disciple, then I suppose I can only read or get anything out of the first half, and the second half will be of no use to me. Or perhaps if somebody thought that he was a disciple, he might say, well, I don't need to bother with the first half anymore. Obviously, I know all that. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a disciple, and I only need to think of the second half. But there is this extraordinary fact that the progress seems to be in a spiral form, and even though we may not be disciples yet, nevertheless, we can find that those ideas which are set forth in the second half for the disciple appear in perhaps a simpler form at the lower stage at which we are, and by contemplating them we can gain the same inspiration and understanding suitable for our level, which we will understand more fully when we actually become disciples. You find interesting conflicts between the teachings given in this book and those in other theosophical books. They are, of course, no conflicts at all when you think about them, but still, you find in some of the rules the word desire coming over and over again. Desire possessions, desire power ardently, and so on. And you find in other theosophical books desirelessness stated as a qualification absolutely essential for treading the path. It's interesting to think about these and to think what is meant in each case. I think the method by which the book was translated from ancient Greek, Egyptian, and perhaps even in the past from older languages, was by the great one who wished to give this book presenting as clearly as he possibly could to the mind of the person who was to write it down the idea which he had understood, and having that individual look at it from every possible point of view, helping him to understand it fully, and then letting him write down what he understood by that idea. I think, in essence, that is the method by which the translation was done. Now, that, of course, is completely different from the methods by which translations are ordinarily done in the outer world, where you take a word, so we say you're translating from French, and this French word means this English word, and you make a translation that way. This had nothing to do with the words. It was simply presenting the spirit or the idea until it was absolutely clear in the person's mind, and then the person wrote that down. And it's not surprising that you find words such as desire occurring, whereas desirelessness would be put down by another as a quality necessary to obtain. I think, and it's purely my own opinion, that in many cases where this word desire occurs, it represents an aspect of the will. Another one that occurs, kill out this, kill out that. And many people approach it from the point of view, very well, this must be killed out, I must repress or drive this thing out of my personality or my nature. I am enough of a believer in psychology to believe that very often such attempts will result in repressions, psychological blocks being built up in one's own nature, and one's own nature very often being absolutely distorted. So I think that when one follows that, or when one tries to understand such an expression as that, one must realize also the danger, although think of it not as meaning, actually picking up and throwing something out of one's nature, but transforming it completely. Now I want, in closing, to read to you one part of it, just a few little extracts, as an example of the understanding, the approach of these great ones towards the path, using this aspect of appreciation of nature. The three rules coming down from antiquity are: listen to the song of life, store in your memory the melody you hear, learn from it the lesson of harmony. Those were the three rules given, which the individual studied and sought to understand. Now, the comment of the great Lord of the Third Ray in Alexandria, and I only quote just a very short part of that comment, only fragments of the great song come to your ears while yet you are but man. But if you listen to it, remember it faithfully, so that none which has reached you is lost, and endeavor to learn from it the meaning of the mystery which surrounds you. In time you will need no teacher, for as the individual has voice, so has that in which the individual exists. Life itself has speech and is never silent, and its utterance is not, as you that are deaf may suppose, a cry. It is a song. Learn from it that you are part of the harmony. Learn from it to obey the laws of the harmony. And then, in a note, the Master Hilarion adds this: look for it and listen to it, first in your own heart. At first you may say, it is not there. When I search, I find only discord. Look deeper. If again you are disappointed, pause and look deeper again. There is a natural melody, an obscure fount in every human heart. It may be hidden over and utterly concealed and silenced, but it is there. All those beings among whom you struggle are fragments of the divine. And so deceptive is the illusion in which you live that it is hard to guess where you will first detect the sweet voice in the heart of others. But know that it is certainly within yourself. Look for it there. And once having heard it, you will more readily recognize it around you. Well, these ideas, I think, set forth some wonderful guiding principles as to how discussions and contributions of different ideas can be set forth, and also wonderful thoughts on how, as we listen to the song of life, we can approach through nature a study of the realities behind.